Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show Alternative Medicine and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. We are live on Blog Talk Radio, Sedona Talk Radio. We are on iTunes, and soon to be in January, we will also have all of our shows on YouTube. So thank you so much for joining us. Please do check out all of the other venues, and we are one or two shows shy of our 200th show marker, and we will also be celebrating that starting on December 24th, where we will be having Health Blast 2015. That means we will have 55 to 60 guests starting on December 24th, straight through, one show every single day. So please do check us out and share your comments and your thoughts along the way. We'd love to hear them. And also, if you'd like to hear some other different topic or another guest, please do also share that. Thank you so much for being on this journey with me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we're just having a great time. Today, I have an absolute wonderful guest with me. I was so excited when I saw the name on the email, would I like to interview John Bradshaw? Are you kidding me? Really? Absolutely, I would love to. I can remember my mother having the book on the table many decades ago, and she obviously read it or had it around or whatever her purpose was, but I did remember the name. And today, John is going to be talking about his new book, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Absolutely a wonderful topic these days. And in what to do when the honeymoon is over. John is a visionary counselor, theologian, best-selling author, and an addiction specialist. You know, if you really look at all of those words, that's really where you come in the decades of life. You know, as you generally get over 50, as we are focusing on in the year 2015, is we realize that we've had all of these life experiences, and it's taken us on some grand journeys. And some things may have seemed like they were not great, or there was too much of a struggle, and just gave up, walked away. Or maybe, you know, it might have taken a ding in my heart. Some people say it's taken them to their knees. Well, you know what? I've been all those places. God bless us all. We can always say, you know what? I got up this morning. I looked outside and the sun was up. Hallelujah. I had another day to breathe. That's the attitude we're going to have going forward. And I would really suggest that to you if you're having a struggle or you're really at that place, just do that simple thing every day. Because you know what? If you've done that, you've done something for the day. And it was a positive thing. So, John, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, too, Jeanette. I really appreciate it.
It's such a wonderful time, I think, in life, you know, where we can say that we're older. And, you know, I don't think we could have had this discussion in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. Do you?
No, I don't. I think that, you know, it's sort of like the time is right now for certain things that are coming out. People's awareness is open and ready for it to a high degree anyway.
Right. And I think it's interesting, too, because we see all of those regulatory things that used to bind us. In other words, what used to tell us how we should live, our morals, our ethics, the church. In my case, it was Roman Catholic, you know, the priests, the nuns, you know, if you did something wrong, you better go to church and you're going to say a rosary for it, you know,
and oh my God.
Right up till today's day, I look at it, you know, I live in the center of New Orleans, and in the past 3 days, there's been several children, you know, just killed, and women in garbage cans and everything, and it's like, what is this world gone to? And I'm really not sure.
No, I totally agree with that. There's just some real covert, pent-up violence in people that astonishes me, the level of it. But
I think
we're breaking out of that rigid, dogmatic past slowly but surely. You know, it just seems to take time, even generations. I think of when I was a child and there were black and white water fountains and sections
right,
on the bus and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And still there's obviously with Ferguson and all that, there's still evidence of race and conflict, but it's not anything like it once was.
Yes, I can remember coming to New Orleans for college. I was going to Loyola University in New Orleans in the early 70s, and the Ku Klux Klan was marching down the street. And I will tell you, people think that those things have gone away. When the Ku Klux Klan, we still had issues after Katrina, which was less than 10 years ago. So I think while we may be experiencing better things in life, I think there's still a lot of darkness holding on to those, and they are just, you know, screaming and yelling. They still want to be heard. It's just time, you know, as we say, awakening, time to turn our back to that.
I totally agree. You know, and I think all we can do is aim for the light and stay positive, as you say, be glad for every morning and every breath we breathe. In my book, by saying, in the evening of life, it's a quote from John of the Cross, a Catholic mystic. In the evening of life, we'll be judged on love alone. And I believe that from the bottom of my heart. I almost died a couple of years ago. I had two near-death experiences. And, you know, when I came out of those, I have quite a collection of antiques and all kinds of stuff. And I just thought, what? None of that makes any difference. What matters is who do you love and what are your relationships and what's your relationship with yourself?
Yes, and it's very hard to shed all of those years of abundance that everybody wanted to have. You know, since World War II, we were on an upswing of collection. We collected degrees, we collected husbands, wives, kids. Then it was on to houses, and then it was how much could you have in your extra garage. And
I think,
you know, when the year 2000 hit, it was a reality of, you know, natural events, you know, all kinds of political events and nature events. And it kind of said, you know, hey, we're going to shake you up a little because that's not where it's at.
Right, totally. So, I mean, we have to each come to our own peace and, you know, live our life to the full, and I think live it by love, knowing that your relationships and your love is what matters maybe more than anything. It isn't all the money you've made or the money you have or anything like that. I have a 7-year-old daughter, which is, you know, I'm 81 with a 7-year-old daughter, but it's been a joy in my life, and my wife and I were able to really save her from a real disastrous situation she was in. So she's just become our baby. But it's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing to have that little girl around.
You know, let's talk about the word love, because it is such a misconstrued thing these days. You know, I see young mothers, they're leaving their kids off at school, and they're saying, I love you, and the other one's saying, I love you more, and the other one's saying, I love you better, and it's like, oh my gosh, you're making me want to throw up. That kid doesn't even know what she's saying. Stop doing that. It's almost like it's abusing the word, because then when they get older, they're not even going to know what they're saying. It's sort of like saying, yes, you know, that hamburger is fabulous. That hamburger is fabulous, you know, or I need French fries when I get my first tooth. They grow up believing these things as dogma, and I don't even think they have a concept on that.
Well, I mean, it's the thesis of my book that chapter one is called Who Taught You the Meaning of Love?
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of words for love, you know, in other languages, Greek and Latin, caritas, the love of God, phileus, friendship, love, eros, erotic love, and agape, deep, mature love. But what I establish in this book, and there have been over at least 100 studies that I know of, where modern adults believe that they don't love their spouse anymore because their sexual desire has waned. And what my book is trying to help people understand, that there's a natural program. This is the work of Helen Fisher, the anthropologist, has discovered doing fMRIs, these MRIs where you can you can test the brain chemistry and the blood in the brain. And she found that lust was one program. These are innate biological programs. And in love was another complete program that lasts, and in her study verified other studies, 12 to 18 months. And so when that program begins to wane, the sexual desire that it revved up begins to wane. And so couples wake up married after a few weeks, and suddenly that wild, passionate, automatic, spontaneous kind of sex has diminished. And that's the first breach, the sexual breach, is what I call post-traumatic stress disorder. That for a high testosterone person, male or female, obviously more males are high T than women, but I had plenty of women counselors, you know, I counseled plenty of women who had a higher sex drive than their husbands did.
Mm-hmm.
One I remember, they won their, you know, they were engaged, and she was very sexual and dressed up in her nurse outfit, and the guy just went anorexic. He just went what I call Madonna anorexia.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that comes from the church and or all churches and the way they teach. But anyway, the loss of sexual desire then is equated by a large part of our population as being the essence of love. And that when you don't desire each other sexually, I don't mean at all, but I mean what you had in love was amazing sex, I call it. This amazing sex, and then all of a sudden, one night, you're going through your spontaneous rhythms, and I have this as a prologue to the book, a guy named Paul and Shirley, and Shirley says, let's just cuddle tonight. Well, Paul is just jolted by that. It's like someone punched him in the stomach.
Right.
And he says, fine, but he doesn't mean fine. And then she says, let's talk about it tomorrow, and they never talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, they're divorced. He's had an affair in the meantime and believes they're not in love because they don't have sexual desire for each other as they once did. Well, what the work of Helen Fisher shows is that's completely normal, that nature in love evolved so that we could meet a partner. It's like... it's not even a feeling, it's an urge. It's a physiological need. And that's what she really discovered, that this is a biological program. She calls it the romance program. And that it is over in 18 months. That is the while, all the things that go with the altered state of consciousness that takes place when you fall in love with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I present a couple there that I counsel who are a little bit extreme, but they really show you all the parts of how crazy being in love can be. And when you're in love, it's like you're drunk and you're in a, you know, you're in a spoon, a swoon. And then when that begins to wear off, you start, you know, kind of getting back to where you were. What all the data shows is that prior to falling in love, the sex drive is such, let's say it's at a 50. After you fall in love, it bumps up to 100. And when you fall out of love, when that 18-month period ends, it goes down to where it was when you started. So you have the high testosterone, often male, and the lower testosterone female. But while she was in love, you know, I remember women saying, I never thought I could love sex so much, or, you know, have sex like I'm having with Jimmy. And yet when that's over, they go back to where they were. And then nature prepares us for attachment. That's the third program that Helen Fisher found. So we have a lust program, we have an in-love program, and we have an attachment program. And the attachment program is what prepares us to nurture the neurotransmitter, the drugs, the vasopressin and oxytocin, what you call the cuddle chemicals. They just take over. And suddenly the mother starts preparing to have a baby. And with that, she moves out of the dopamine and the norepinephrine, which was revving up her sex drive, into vasopressin and oxytocin, which is preparing her to mother her children. Now, Gottman, John and Julie Gottman did a study of 150 couples over 30 years. 89% said our marriage got worse after the first child. It got worse after the second child.
Right.
And several said it wasn't okay till they went off to college. That it didn't get back until, and for some that was too late. Now, that's a shocking thing. It shocked John Gottman, who's the researcher. But it shows you that there's a lot we don't know, that if we had this data, we could be prepared for it. It's why I'm pushing it. You know, give this book to your adolescents. Help them understand what's going on in their biology. And people then would be more prepared as they settle down and start family or, you know, having children, they know that there's going to be a diminishment of that intense, amazing sex and that the whole thing that happens when you're in love, where you focus on only the good parts of your... I had a woman come in. I'd counseled her for a year. She had been battered in two relationships. She comes in and tells me, it's about a year later, I thought she was doing great. Says, well, I have a new lover. He's so wonderful. Let me just tell you how honest he is. On our second date, he told me he killed a man.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I almost fell off the chair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But she thought that was some great positive that he told her about this on the second date. Instead of getting the hell out of there as fast as she could.
Yes.
But anyway,
misconstrued.
So the in love just makes everything warped, and, you know, it takes her 45 minutes to get dressed. That's so cute when you're in love. Suddenly you get married and you're screaming and hollering, and what is it taking you so long for? And he's got a raucous sense of humor. That was cute when you were in love, but now that you're married, you're embarrassed by him. All the things that you were attracted to, or many of them, can become negatives after you're married, and you're out of that, well, really, altered state of consciousness, out of that drunkenness. It's like you're in the hangover period. And so couples have not known how to be prepared for that. If I've heard one man say to me, I've heard 500, I love my wife, but I'm not in love with her. And they always tell me that as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, you know, duh, that's exactly what's supposed to happen.
Right.
That in love is going to end, and then you need to build on your friendship and your caring and your sharing. And men do have this new, you know, they have the vasopressin and the oxytocin when they really want their baby, but so many people marry pregnant and they don't want the baby. And then you see all these teenage marriages. My own family history is just dominated by teenage marriages and pretty much disaster coming out of that. So we gotta, you know, have our youngsters understand and our oldsters. Because you can be, I talk about post-traumatic stress disorder as having 4 degrees. The first is the sexual breach. Now, if you have low self-esteem, if you're severely codependent, if you're an addict or a recovering addict or just a complete shame-based person, you're going to experience a deep trauma when that thing ends. Because you're going to feel that you're being rejected. Whoever the high testosterone person is. And that's not the case, but it's what it feels like to them. And so immediately they go into hiding. There's no talking anymore. And you once talked about everything, but it becomes awkward and embarrassing, kind of, to talk about personal things where you wouldn't have thought for a second talking about them when you were in love and courting.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get into that second stage, that post-traumatic stress disorder, now healthy people manage it fairly well. That is, those with a fairly good sense of self. But people with no sense of self, like codependency is a disease of the developing self. You don't have a good self. You depend on, and those are the people that will be so dependent on their love partner for their own identity and their own security. You see it in love when, you know, one couple just hangs on every word of their partner and changes anything that they think the partner is unhappy about and just kind of gives up their life for that partner. So this in love state is nothing, no Mickey Mouse thing. It's deadly serious because nature wants us to reproduce and have babies and extend our DNA in space and time. And one of the most fascinating things I discovered in this book, writing this book, is from the heart transplant and lung transplant people who showed us that our bodies can tell the difference between compatible and incompatible DNA. And the DNA is what sorts for diseases through a function called the human lymphocyte antigen. I'm losing people probably, but there's a profile you can make, and it has what you have become immune to in diseases, and it passes that on to your children. When you marry somebody, and what all the tests have shown is you will be attracted. You'll have chemistry for somebody with an opposite DNA or HLA profile, so that your children get both of your immunities to disease. Nature wants complexity, and the whole universe expands, what's called the new sphere, expands by ever-increasing complexity. So we have all our theories about why people choose their partners and all that, and they're fantasy, basically. Some of them may be helpful in, you know, in doing therapy with people, but basically nature. The first half of my book is called Mother Nature's Old Black Magic. And so you better know what nature is doing, or else, you know, you're going to wind up in the middle of a marriage and think you have no connection anymore and leave that marriage because the sexual desire has diminished. And I have a quote from one of the leading therapists on family and marriage, Pat Love, who wrote a book called The Truth of Love, which is a very good book, and wrote a book called Hot Monogamy. And yet she says that the saddest thing in my life is that I left a perfectly decent man who was the father of my three children. It's like a regret she will always have. And that's a perfect expression of post-traumatic stress disorder, that you leave somebody because you don't have sexual desire for them, or you don't have what you once had. You certainly love the person, and you have the cuddling. You still want the cuddling and the contact, but the genital sex diminishes in its intensity. And so a lot of people just don't know how to handle that, and they think they've fallen out of love. So
don't
my
you think
book
so?
Is presenting these new discoveries.
Don't you think so? Maybe in the beginning, if we look at it, when you say that people are looking to be attracted to opposite of the HLA, the antigens, and, you know, that would in turn help them to resist disease later on, but also to bring them together to co-create. And it's really sometimes I think now what we are noticing in probably the last three decades or so is that people came together and it was just too quick. There was no, you were really basing your actions upon what you thought was right, getting into something really quickly, and realizing that, hey, this doesn't work or it does work, but always thinking about the disposable end of it. In other words, when our ancestors got married, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and we think about that, we say, well, they did love each other for their whole life because that was more time. They spent more time with each other. They were more vested in it. They were more attracted to each other. And now it's really, it's almost like, I almost think of us as red ants. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're there because you know, you're more like spun up on this high energy all the time now. And you're just kind of like hit and missing all through life. And you're just, you know, everything's disposable. It doesn't matter if I like her or don't like her. I can let her go. I can get somebody else. And we don't have any commitment to anything. Therefore, in the beginning process, when we're meeting somebody, we're really not even telling the truth about ourselves. So I think in the beginning, we don't know who we are. Like, our ancestors knew who they were to some degree, and they learned together over life. But now we're really coming into relationships where we seriously don't know who we are, and we have no intentions of growing together.
Yeah, Stephanie Kuntz, who's a historian in Washington, D.C., wrote a book called Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Because prior to the 19th century, marriages were arranged for political or economic reasons. And it wasn't about being in love. In fact, they would think that in love was a flimsy condition to place love and the future of a family and all that on. But gradually, the in-love began to take over, and we have what we have today, although we're not at all, equipped for long-term marriage, which is what is a possibility for everybody today. So I totally agree. Couples should stay together for a while, get through that in-love height and, intensity, and then and see how they are as just two persons living together. Because the movies, I cite 12 movies. They're all love stories. Dr. Zhivago, Titanic, When Harry Met Sally. All those movies are love stories, and they never show you what happens after they get married. So you don't have any idea of what's coming, which is what I call phase two of a healthy relationship, which is working through the family. I call it the family blockade, because you're coming out of a family that has all kind of rules, both covert and overt, rules about marriage, rules about money, rules about children, rules about vacations, rules about how to keep the house. All of that is going to happen when the swoon wears off, when you fall out of the infatuation stage. Now you got to deal with real differences. And the two families of origin have to come together and deal with their differences. And if you don't know how to argue well or have any conflict resolution skills, which I certainly didn't have when I got married, then you're going to have a terrible time. Gottman's say that the essence of a good marriage is how well you argue. Can you come to a conclusion that allows you to advance, to grow, instead of getting stuck in the same spot and you have the same fight over and over and over again? I have a chapter in the book called... Go ahead.
It's almost like when you, after that time period, that's when you start what I say is unpacking your bags. In other words, all of your baggage from all of your life that you've lived, or how you've grown up, or how your parents lived, or whatever. In other words, all of this stuff that goes on in your head and your brain and everything, that's when you start unpacking it. So in other words, you start seeing a new map folding out. You see, okay, I'm going to have kids, and am I going to treat them like my parents treated me? Or am I going to go down the same road and my mother stayed home and I have to stay home? Or am I going to be with someone that abuses me or whatever? So in other words, after that time period, that's when you really settle in and unpack your bags. And what you're doing is you're unpacking your emotional and your psyche baggage. And it's just who's going to take out the laundry? You know, are you going to take care of it? Or are you going to deny it? Or are you going to shove it under the rug? Or are you going to really go at it, you know?
Well, and most couples don't have any idea about the baggage from the pack and how that's affecting the future, you know, the present.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, many don't want to do anything about it. You know, they'll say, well, I don't care what happened early on. I'm doing great now. Well, that's valid, but sometimes it may mean that you're having severe intimacy problems because you haven't really left that family of origin. You know, Gurdjieff, the great philosopher, said until you're in, you can't have a good relationship until you've finished your source relationships. That is, you've got to grieve the abandonment, the abuse, whatever, the neglect that you had as a child, or hopefully you didn't have those. You still have to leave home. And that means you've got to be willing to have all your rules meet another person's rules and find good compromises, or hopefully you have the same rules. But and that's kind of why it's good to, you know, date somebody that has the same background as you. But on the other hand, you know, you've got to know how to deal with conflict. And lots of us didn't know how to do that.
Well, I think in our 30s, 40s, and 50s was when we had to learn about that. I don't think that we were ever equipped to do that in our 20s. You know, in early 30s when people get married. And now we look at kids that are getting married. No, they're all different ages anymore. And all of the older people now are just dropping off their husbands on the corner, you know. They're just like, I'm done with the childish stuff, you know. Here you go.
Absolutely.
You know, you can take your video games and go find somewhere else, you know.
Absolutely.
But it's just
I'm hoping, and I'm probably promoting this book more than I have any of my other books. I was in the dentist for a root canal the other day, and he bought 15 books, one for every one of his girls in the office.
Goodness.
And I'm soliciting, you know, I'm telling people, because you need to know this. I mean, you can't get a valid picture of what married life is, of what raising a family is, unless you understand what nature is doing, you know, what your biological inheritance is.
Right.
And it's not everything, but it's if you disallow it, you're going to be sorry.
And, John, you also, over the decades, have been preaching on the dysfunctional family and everything. So I think this really is an important time also to state that you don't need to stay with anyone when they start unpacking those bags if that is not something in which is a healthy thing. So can you talk a little bit about that?
No, you don't, and you probably didn't see any of that while you were in love and in the in-love, bona fide, altered state of consciousness.
Right.
You'll start noticing the differences after that wears off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if one person's Jewish and the other is charismatic Catholic, they're going to have a hell of a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can predict what's going to happen when I see some
right.
of that. And they're in love, and they're saying, well, love will conquer all. And my boyfriend's a heroin addict, but I know I can get him off the drugs.
Right.
And it's just so crazy. And that there needs to be, I have a chapter in there on realistic expectations. And, you know, they've shown that in long-term couples, some of their feuds have never been worked out. They've just gotten to a point where they've compromised. But you may not work everything out, but still you can come to a compromise. You can come to a comfortable place. And one of the things that I really stress in the second part of the book is something I learned in my own recovery from alcoholism. I heard a guy in a meeting say one night, you have to act yourself into a right way of thinking and feeling. Don't try to think and feel yourself into a right way of acting. And this is especially true of couples that have been together a while and are caught up in this squirrel cage. He bitches and she bitches and nags, and he won't talk. Why won't you talk? Because she bitches and nags. Why do you bitch and nag? Because he won't talk. And it's just a squirrel cage. It's a game without end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ineffectual fighting does. You're still fighting the same problem 15 years later, and you haven't done anything to change it. So this principle of acting yourself into a right way of thinking, and then as I began writing the second part of this book, I had been in touch in my previous book called Reclaiming Virtue. I'd been in touch with the work of Alan Schwartz at Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA, who worked with obsessive-compulsively disordered patients. And he found that by taking an MRI of their brain and doing a four-step program that really involved willpower, you know, learning that, you know, they knew about their disease, they knew they didn't want to wash their hands, but being able to say to yourself, that's my sick brain talking. And anyway, in 10 weeks, they took an fMRI before and an fMRI afterwards. Their brains had been changed. The very structure of the brain was changed, especially around the compulsivity. So what that means is that the will is a physical force that can change the brain. Now, a person has to want to do it, but if they're willing, just taking the actions. Like as a therapist, at the end of my counseling, when I really had a lot of success, I'd say, you come to me, you don't know what to do, you're stuck. Neither one of you knows what to do. So I'm going to tell you what to do. I can help you out of this. But if you you have to do exactly what I tell you to do. And if you don't, I'm going to end the counseling. Now, that may be strange therapeutic approach, but I had enormous success with that. Because they didn't know what to do. That's why they were there.
Now, let's talk about, John, when we are older also and there is no more intimacy, and you look at people that are in their 50s and 60s and now their kids are leaving home and their life is changing and everything, and, you know, retirement comes up. But then also comes up Alzheimer's and dementia, and it's sort of like, you know, you have women now who are, I think, in this situation you're talking about, this age group, when these women are leaving these men off, it's like the women are saying, you know, my life hasn't been what I wanted it to be, and I don't see it changing in the next 10 years, so I'm going to let this one off, and I'm going to get on another ride, because I don't want to end up with dementia or Alzheimer's or dying and not have had that experience.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's in other words, this book and the stuff in it is relevant for long-term marriages. That's what I'm aiming at in the second part of the book, to know some of the observed stages, what therapists have observed over the years, that you come out of that in love stage. That's a non-working prelude to love. In other words, you don't have to do much work when you're in love. It's very spontaneous and automatic. The second you come out of that trance and you start dealing with the two families and the family of origin and the family of origin baggage, that's very nice the way you put that, you start unpacking your baggage, then you have to have some real skills to work through that. And you may get to a point where you're just completely incompatible. Or you may get to a point later on. Now, I think that the vows of I take this man, I take this woman for better or worse in sickness and in health, I think that's a beautiful vow. People have to be fairly mature to take that vow. And a lot of youngsters aren't. They don't really have any idea what they're talking about when they say it. Well, but maybe, you know, this one couple that I describe as in the last stage. The first stage is in love. The second is working through the family of origin and working through your own baggage. Then you move toward independence and you help each other become independent. It's like if you want a career and your spouse needs to be helping you have your career so you can find your sense of self, your own unique identity. And when you're really in love, you help each other find that sense of identity. You're there for each other. Even though she's going back to school or she's getting a new job to get out in the world now, now that the children are half grown or almost grown, and really support each other. And then you come to the, you know, the stage of, I know who I am, and I know who you are, and I am I, because what the old rabbi said in 1679, if I am I because I am I, and you are you because you are you, then I am and you are. But if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not and you are not. It's that sick codependency where you're two people in a canoe and you can't move without the other one being affected by it. It's the ideal state is the last stage, which shared, that you play music together, but you play the violin and he plays the piano, but you play the same song. It's like each has their own individuality. You know that if your spouse died, you could go on. You could even have another life after that. But throwing away the marriage at an old, you know, an old age, it's really tragic. It says that they haven't built anything together.
Well, I'm going to make all marriage advocates angry when I say this, but you know that what you just referenced about the marriage vow, was, you know, zillions of years ago, whenever that came up, whatever, in history. But the point is, too, is that we are, in this past several decades, living almost double what we used to.
Oh, absolutely.
And now we're asking, people when they're at 20 and 30 to say a vow for all of these decades. I think that's really a huge change, where I think marriage, love, intimacy, romance, all this is going to be really shooken up, and let's see where we go from here, because really people are living so much longer. So it really, the marriage vow is an antiquated thing, and I take that as a grain of salt. It's something that was set in stone, but it was a long time ago, and it was based upon at that time. Do you know what I'm saying?
So I totally agree with that.
Our vow needs to shift and change and say, I take you for the next 50 years. You know what I mean? Am I going to take you for 80 years?
Yeah, I mean,
years?
You can make up your own vows. The people that did that. And then I had, like, the couple I described in the last stage, they renewed their vows every year. They made their own vows. And they sort of renewed them as circumstance came up, and the way each one of them grew, and fortunately this couple loved to do new things, and that's a great thing for an ailing marriage, to start doing things neither one of you have ever done and do them together. Can be a huge thing. They've even shown that it can reignite romance. But anyway, I mean, there's lots of things people can do, and I agree they shouldn't be set in stone. But the idea of that commitment was, it was a commitment that I'm going to stand by you, and you're going to stand by me. And, you know, what the problem is of not standing by each other, the woman's going to often be left with the children or the mortgage or whatever, you know, and her whole life has been around being the nurturer of the children and the family. And but it's going to be an individual thing, but you need to know what Mother Nature's doing to you. What are the evolutionary signs that are in that in love program, and that it's going to end? It was never intended for a long-term relationship. It was simply intended to get you to meet someone, and someone that you're chemically compatible with, in order to hope you'll mate and procreate, so
and
that the DNA goes on in space and time.
And then look at the other end of it, too, now, because I do a lot of work with end of life. And what I'm finding is that women and men over the age of when they hit that 64, 67 range, there is a huge increase in fear. I mean, it is a fear like nobody's business that they are going to have some debilitating disease and that other person won't be there, or that they will be left alone and they will die alone, or that they just haven't had that life that they wished. So really, when you look at the age of 64 to 67, I think that's almost like hitting a wall or hitting or a bottoming out. We look at addictions, you know, they hit the ground, whatever. I think that also is a very huge marker for people because, you know, they say, what next? You know, I'm super panicked. Now you're telling me I'm going to live another 30, 40 years I didn't plan on? And
yep.
It's like, wow, now what?
Well, you know, I think that's the thing about renewable vows, to make a commitment that part of your commitment is we'll renew the commitment every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll try to see where we are, how it's going. We'll try to be compatible and adult with each other. If you raise children, you have a responsibility to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief component of a happy family is the marriage. If the marriage is dysfunctional, the family's going to be dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids are going to have to carry those wounds out into their own lives. You and I
Absolutely.
Talked about that earlier on, that both of us,
yep.
or at least I can say I came from a very dysfunctional family.
Right.
Somehow I escaped it. Maybe I had better breaks. I don't know, but I did. And everyone else is dead that was my family of origin. And they live tragic lives.
Yes.
Just tragic lives.
And that's so difficult.
So, I mean, there's a lot of work for us to do. And
yes.
if you've come out of dysfunction and you're still dysfunctional, you know, you almost are going to have a dysfunctional relationship. You know, hockey players don't hang around with chess players necessarily or motorcycle
yeah.
guys. So you pick a partner, and, you know, you have to pick a partner that's compatible, and
mm-hmm.
You may be attracted by their, you know, their aggressiveness or their romance or whatever, but give yourself a chance. Don't rush into formal marriage, and don't
yeah.
rush into having babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a time now when we control having babies.
Yes.
But you tell this to a 16-year-old on drugs, and you're talking mm-hmm. to the wind.
Well, you know, John
James Hollis says you can't do therapy with people who are in love.
Yes.
And look at that Hollywood bunch, the marriages and the divorces. And I mean, it's just one in-love program after another.
Well, my children, John, are 23 to 33, and there's not one child in sight.
There's not one child what?
They don't have any children at all.
Well, I mean, I remember
saying
I'm never bringing a kid into the world to suffer like my brother and sister and I suffered,
yeah.
my mother. You know, I mellowed on that after a while. But, I mean, it's not imperative that you have a child. It's
right.
it's you know, it's something that people should really want to be together on, that idea. Know that it's going to be really difficult. It's going to change your relationship. Because the moment
yeah.
you have a child, there's a triangle. And the
mm-hmm.
husband feels neglected by the mother because she has to give this child all this time and affection and nurturing. And ideally, you know, we've moved into, the good thing is we've moved into a more democratic parenting where it's both parents' obligation to
mm-hmm.
breadwin, you know, be the breadwinner and take care of the
right.
children. It's not just the woman's to be the housewife and take care of the children. And that's
mm-hmm.
causing a lot of divorces, too, because a lot of men have trouble adapting to that they're not superior to the woman they married, that you're both the same and you can't build intimacy out of anything but sameness and
mm-hmm.
acceptance, that you're both worthy people in your own right. You both have an individual right to everything that's going on. But I tell you, it is frightening. I start at the beginning of the book. The divorce rate is 51%, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
what's also disturbing is that 33 of the 50% that stay married, 17% continually in studies say I'm unhappy and I wished I'd never gotten married. So it means only 33% are left being happy in marriage. And I quote a big study that was done where you know, people were saying over and over again, I just don't want to get married. I don't want to get married. Why?
Right.
Because they see the divorce and the pain that it causes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know,
I mean, we've got...
But don't
there
you
is
think
hope.
More that
I mean,
they...
people can change. That's what
yes.
this brain research is saying. The
yes.
plasticity of the brain, you can change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you may get to a point where too much baggage has just contaminated your relationship. And I say if you really made an effort, you can't change your partner. You can only change yourself. The only way you're going to change your partner is by changing yourself. You got to change your behavior for at least 30 days, 90 days, I say, to see what the response is going to be. And if you do that six or seven times and you still get no response, those are grounds for divorce. Because
right.
what this partner is saying, I don't care what you do, I'm not going to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we can change the other person if we're willing to change ourselves.
Yeah.
Now, that's a hard prescription to swallow for a lot of people, especially
Don't you think maybe towards the end of our life now, really the goal needs to be, you know, after your kids are leaving home or whatever and out on their own, the goal really needs to be that you just plain need to be happy with yourself first, but be happy in life. Because you know
I
what,
totally
you really,
agree.
You can't, your time is ticking away. Don't waste time.
No, I totally agree.
And be
there
unhappy.
Ought to be marriage contracts for different
yes.
periods. You
right,
know, and after
right.
your kids grow up, my first marriage
yeah.
was 20 years. My kids grew up. But it was,
yeah.
it was a marriage that just had so much trouble in it. And I didn't, even though I was running around teaching about the family, I didn't know exactly what to do. I didn't have any tools. And I realized
mm-hmm.
now you've got to have some tools.
Yeah.
You can change things, but you've got to have some tools. You have to
yeah.
know how. I have the longest chapter in my book is on effective communication, how to
mm-hmm.
argue well. And you can do that. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to, it guarantees you staying married, but it means you'll have a good idea of what your conflicts are about. And you're going to carry those into your next marriage if you
mm-hmm.
have another marriage, if you haven't resolved them in the one you're in. So, I mean, I'm very much for couples working it out, but at the same time, I counsel several people to get a divorce when I just saw there was no way that this was working in any shape or form. Or they were
mm-hmm.
at a point where they both wanted out.
Yeah.
And if
and
you were, you know, renewing
okay.
your vows every year, that could be, okay, we're heading into old age and here's what that could look like. What are we going to do? You know, are we going to stay separated, or do we want to separate,
right.
or do we want to stay together, or, you know, and try to work out something that's compatible for both of you.
Right.
It's a hard deal. It really is.
It is a hard deal because you're really asking someone to lay themselves bare and say, will you take care of me in old age when I don't look like this, I don't smell like this, I don't care like this, I'm not bringing that money in, and maybe I can't walk or maybe I can't go on the motorcycle like I used to. Will you still love me? So that's really what you're asking them. And
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
If you use that, if you take that phrase and you take that and put that in place of those old-fashioned, you know, marriage vows that don't work anymore for the long haul, maybe that may be where people will say, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. Maybe not, you know. It'll give you a chance to reflect.
Yeah, I think it's something that has to be looked at, and I think that we may see marriages emerge in a different way than we have in the past. Because
yeah.
the democracy, the... You know, that you're equal, and that's what is
mm-hmm.
going to be the ground for intimacy if you're going to have it. You can't have one of you one up and the other one down.
Right.
So you have to work it out together.
Well, John, do you know we've gone right through this hour? It's been such a pleasure having you. I think we'll have to have you back another time because we just can't stop talking.
I'd love to come back with you. I can't believe we've been an hour.
I know.
That's amazing.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I think we'll have you come back in February. How about that? That would be a great
month. That would be great because I'm happy to promote this. I think it's important.
Yeah.
It's important for people to understand it.
Absolutely.
See,
and also
again,
understand that it's okay.
Yeah, well, understand it and work something out and be willing to change, be willing to work on it, or be willing to move on, whatever you come to.
Right.
So, but I saw a lot of compatible people that gave up because they didn't have the sexual desire that they had had when they were in the romance, infatuation period. And that's more what I'm after in this book, is to stop unnecessary divorces, especially when there's already a child there or two children there. Because I'm a child of divorce. It was horrible when my parents divorced. Even though my dad was an alcoholic and it was terrible living with him. But I remember being a kid, and as late as when I was 30 years old, I was still trying to get them back together again.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids experience that very differently than the couples do, and if they decide to bring children in the world, they have an obligation to that.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Well, John, it
thank
is
you
an absolute
so much.
Pleasure. Thank
you're
you
great.
So much for being with us.
I
it was
love
a wonderful
it,
show.
You're a wonderful questioner. I mean, it's great with your knowledge to have the time with you.
Oh, thank you so much. And we will have you back in February, okay?
Okay, dear. Sounds good.
Thank you. You have
bye-bye.
A great evening. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to find out more information about John Bradshaw's book, it's Post-Romantic Stress Disorder, What to Do When the Honeymoon is Over, please do check out his book. His website is on the bottom of today's show page. It is johnbradshaw.com, where you can check out more information about John. All of his other books are listed on that page, and you'll find out so much more information about where he is. Hey, you may be able to come and see him one time when he's speaking. It's an absolute pleasure to have him with us. I'll tell you, maybe we really need to start thinking about looking at each other and saying, you know what? I do. I care about you. I will take care of you. I hear you. I pay attention to you, and I do love you. Instead of all this other frills that is on the media and all of these social media and these televisions and everything else, maybe we just need to start finding out what works for us. So thank you so much for being with us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It's a pleasure to have you with us, and we do hope that you check out Health Blast 2015, which will be starting on December 24th, and it will be almost 60 guests now, right straight through to the middle of February. Well, now the end of February, because we are having John coming back. So thank you so much for joining.